City Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams.
Good morning. Here.
Fish.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Potter.
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity they are authorized to represent. Please read the first communication.
Item 832, request of Glenn Owen to address Council regarding impeachment resolution.
Glenn Owen. Please read the next.
833, request of Wyatt Rowe to address Council regarding homeless shelters.
Please read the next.
834, request of Katie Nielsen to address Council regarding sit, lie, and anti-camping laws.
You state your name for the record and you have 3 minutes.
My name is Katie Nielsen. As someone who has worked in human services for approximately 9 years, with youth, men, women, and children in crisis, who has worked the past 3 years as a Cascadia employee, working with education and community building with our homeless neighbors struggling with mental health and addiction issues, I have purposed my life around building relationships, bringing people together, creating understanding, facilitating dialogue, though I admit I have not always lived up to these expectations. As of late, I'm humbled by the intensity of my reactions to your city's response to our cries for justice now, for the halting of a failing 10-year plan, for a dialogue that will address the crisis today, which is not so much homelessness itself as it is the implementation of the sit, lie, and anti-camping ordinances that criminalize life in its most basic and essential forms. I've stepped back recently to reflect on some of my involvement, questioning how my voice, our voices, can be heard when we struggle to face you with the same respect we desire in return. But we keep coming back, trying new angles, asking new questions that look at the same issues differently, hoping that our message will escape the broken record status it seems to hold, and that we can figure out a way to work together. But how can we work together when we're angry at each other and when we don't trust one another? Since this protest began, people without homes have been swept from camps more regularly. They're being displaced even before notices have been posted. If we have done anything, it seems we have activated an even heavier hand upon those who have to hide to sleep, most of whom have never stepped foot in these chamber halls. If there is a problem with what you are faced here with here in this community courtroom, where we bring before the public the sins of our elected officials, then please deal with us. We have come bearing testimony week after week for 2 months, asking for dialogue, asking for a seat at the negotiation table, asking for something more than a simple dismissal through your resounding silence. Yet, the laws live on and the silence continues. We admit we have not always spoken in turn, with patience, with kindness, or respect. However, we are the community that you serve, a collective, resonant voice that is deserving of a dignified response. With 1,950 postcards demanding the repeal of the sit, lie, and anti-camping laws draped around the chambers and containing the names of supporters in our community, Mayor Potter, your only response was, don't forget to pick up the cards. If you are going to continue enforcing the breaking of the constitutional rights, it's our responsibility to hold you accountable. My voice may be dissenting, however, it is not my purpose to be divisive. For any part I have taken in that, I offer my apology. However, I will not apologize for standing up to the continued unapologetic authorization of these inhumane ordinances. Mayor Potter, commissioners, you owe us a response. You owe us more than a response. You owe us an apology. Though, as we all know, words fail, but actions count for everything. Thank you.
Please read the next name.
835, request of Larry D. Reynolds to address Council regarding homeless protests against sit, lie, and no camping ordinances.
Good morning. Please state your name when you speak. You have 3 minutes.
My name is Larry Reynolds. Good morning. The homeless protest at City Hall began 4/25 this year. I became part of this protest on 4/28/08 because I was swept out from under the Hawthorne Bridge by an officer, Anthony Zanetti, at 11 p.m. in the evening. It was a rainy night. He told us to go to the other side of the river because camping over there was more accepted by the businesses on that side. We moved to that side of the river, and we were told the same thing over there, that we weren't allowed to be there. The camp that we were at, where five other persons, was not trashed out. There was no drug use. There was no alcohol use. There was no violence. We were simply sleeping. We're taking a stand against the city of Portland and the Bureau of Police. We're just plain tired of having my and watching others around me have their human, civil, and constitutional rights violated by public servants who swear to protect and serve. I witnessed many, many times homeless or poor in this city get abused either physically or mentally by certain, not all, officers within the police bureau. Private security companies are also involved. Portland Clean and Safe, Portland Patrol, Securitas, Whack and Hut, TriMet Security, amongst others. The root of these abuses are the sit and lie ordinance and the no camping ordinance created by City Hall and the Portland Business Alliance. They are enforced by the Portland Police Bureau and the aforementioned security agencies. These two ordinances and their enforcements are in violation of our human, civil, and constitutional rights. These laws and ordinances must be repealed. The homeless and the poor are being targeted. We are being criminalized for being homeless and poor. What began as just a simple protest has blossomed into a far broader and in-depth issues. What is important? What are our priorities, governmental and individual? Who really cares? i.e., the community, the government, this city council? Well, I've got quite a list. And this, being I am out of time, this statement that I'm making now will continue at a later date. Thank you.
836, request of Robert Archambault to address council regarding homeless, sit-lie ordinances, and research of people and statistics.
Yeah. Poo.
State your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes.
Hi, I'm Robert Archambault. I'm 22 years old. I've been homeless for 3 years. You could give us an unoccupied building to use. Certain individuals may say it's not that simple, but most of the buildings need to be brought up to date in code with all building standards. 30 to 60% of all houseless people do work. It's harder for 40% of the houseless people to get work because they have no storage. They have to carry all their belongings on their back. Beginning this year, 4,000 to 4 million people will lose their housing because of economical reasons and bank foreclosures. So as time goes on, it's only going to get bigger and worse. I am honestly doing everything I could do to be housed. However, I will not touch most of these shelters because the health department let them slide with unhealthy and unsanitary food serving conditions. I have reason to believe that shelters have been using a certain percentage of federal funding to line their pockets. Most of the food donations that are given to the houseless shelters are never seen by the houseless people. All the programs downtown are used for people with drug issues, but there are a lot of people that don't use drugs. That leaves them with no choice in their mind but to do drugs, for certain of them. I have 9 pages of federal cases going towards cities and states for criminalizing homeless or houseless people. That's 19 cases. In one case, 5 people gained $1,000 in the city and state had to pay their lawyer's attorney fees. For the most part, the cities had to drop the sidewalk obstruction and camping ordinances. Plus, I could get more from across the world from the internet. We, as in all people, need to gain pride in helping in each other's rights. Most people say, none of us have skills, so I just brought a copy of my resume to show. Plus, I have more skills because I've been working since I was 15. The U.S. government is pulling the same thing as kings and queens of the past, what started revolutions and revolutionary wars. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Well, I could get some more copies if you want me to.
You can make some copies and drop them off in my office.
Yeah, no problem.
Is that the communications?
That's all. Yes.
Okay, we'll move to the consent agenda. Do any commissioners wish to pull any items from the consent agenda?
Mayor, I've had occasion to talk to Commissioner Saltzman about pulling number 875 and adding it to our regular agenda when we take up the companion ordinances 895, 896, and 897, and he does not object.
875. Okay. That'll be placed at the end of the regular agenda then?
No, it would be placed, Mayor, with the presentation on the related matters at 895, 896, and 897.
Okay. Okay, does any member of this audience wish to pull any specific item from the agenda? Hearing none, please call the vote.
Adams.
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Move to the 9:30 time certain. Please read item 837.
Adopt Portland Fire and Rescue's revised and updated standard of emergency response coverage.
Commissioner Fish?
Thank you, Mayor. As you know, I have the great honor of serving as the fire commissioner of the city of Portland. The Portland Fire and Rescue is requesting the City Council today to adopt the second edition of the Standard of Emergency Response Coverage, or SERC, document. This document is the blueprint for how Portland Fire and Rescue delivers services to the City of Portland. The SERC guides operational decisions and establishes objectives in the Fire and Rescue Strategic Plan and Annual Business Plan. Portland Fire and Rescue has been able to add resources based on demands identified in the 2004 edition of the SERC, specifically a new rescue at Station 11. This additional rescue has enabled Portland Fire and Rescue to improve both response time and response reliability to Station 11's fire management area. By adopting the 2008 edition of the SERC, Portland Fire and Rescue can continue to maintain its accredited status with the Commission on Fire Accreditation International, as well as continue to evaluate and address operational challenges and opportunities. I'm pleased to invite up to the microphone Mark Schmidt, who's the Division Chief of Operations, Alyssa Brumfield, who is the Project Manager, and I also wish to acknowledge that John Knorr, the Fire Marshal, and Scott Fisher, the Chief Training Officer, are also present here today. Chief?
Hi, I'm Mark Schmidt, as I was introduced. I'm here today requesting the adoption of the Portland Fire and Rescue Standard of Emergency Response Coverage document, as the Commissioner stated. This will allow us to continue in the accreditation process with the Commission on Fire Accreditation International. And is it okay if I mention Chief Klum's absence today? Chief Klum is not here today to present this because he had a reaction to a medication he's taking and was unable to drive in for the process. So I'm here today. I'll do the best I can to answer your questions on this process. And again, not to repeat anything that the commissioner said, but this is actually a blueprint for our operations. It is defining the current levels of services within the fire service in the fire bureau and our goals and objectives. The real value of this document is that it required us to do an in-depth review of our core values and acknowledge and commit to the challenges in this process. And as you can see by the document in front of you, this was quite a commitment. The report includes a comprehensive coverage of the department overview, a risk assessment, response times, that is our goals and how realistic they are, our resources throughout the city, how they're distributed and concentrated, the response reliability of our resources, which helped drive the addition of Rescue 19 and Rescue 11. Our EMS services that we provide to Multnomah County, our service goals, and our future needs. The basis for requesting and implementing a 4th Battalion in the city was based on this document, which addressed a long-standing span of control issue we had. It also identified efficiencies and opportunities with dispatch operations, which have allowed us to improve some response times just in our call processing. It originally was adopted in 2004. We will adopt it again in 2010 in preparation for the 2011 CFAI process, which is a 5-year cycle. Adoption today of this adoption of the CERC document today will allow us to continue to develop the document as a blueprint for operations and allow us to meet the requirements of the CFAI accreditation process in 2011. Thank you. And I would like to defer to Alyssa Brumfield, who has a PowerPoint presentation, if you want to see that. I think the commissioner covered this in some detail, but we're happy to present the PowerPoint if you would like to see that.
I just happen to know that this is a very tough standard to meet, so I think it'd be good for everybody to see.
Okay.
Okay. So you're interested in seeing the PowerPoint?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll try to make it quick. So as Mark mentioned, we did present the last standard of cover to you guys in 2004, and it was adopted. There are several questions, because it was the first time we went through accreditation, and it was a very lengthy process. It actually took us 2 years to become accredited. And completing the standard of emergency response coverage, in addition to doing our 5-year strategic plan, are probably 60% of the accreditation process. So there's a great value on doing a standard of cover and having that in place prior to accreditation. So it really is, a large component of our accreditation, and we want to maintain that with CFAI because we think it's a really important standard to meet. We think it makes us a better fire department and encourages us to seek ways to improve service delivery. And so by doing this every 2 years, I think that it's very worthwhile. What is the standard of emergency response coverage? We tend to call it a CERC. So if you hear us saying CERC, that's what we're talking about, just because it gets a little bit lengthy. We talk about deployment and response times. We look at risks in the community and what are our target hazards, what areas do we need to focus our resources so that we have adequate resources there to handle the demand. We look at past performance, so we do a lot of trending and data analysis, and then we use that information to establish our goals for the future. And then, of course, we develop future plans and goals for how we're going to deliver emergency operations services. Why adopt a standard of coverage? Well, number one, as I mentioned, it's required. This is one of the major components of CFAI accreditation. That's the Commission on Fire Accreditation International. There are 122 currently accredited, with three of those international. Those are all located in Canada. And City Council is the only governing body that can adopt the standard of cover. We can't just adopt it within the fire department. It has to come before council. So that is again, why we're here today. And it sets a clear level of service to the community that we serve. It is the way for council to adopt that level of service and acknowledge that this is what we can deliver with the resources we have. We may have goals for the future, but this is what we can do now. So you may see a gap between our actual response times and our response time goals or objectives. And that's because this is a level of service they can expect us to deliver even if we're not quite at our goal. So we want to have our goal out there even if we're not quite meeting it. Who developed this CERC document? We had a leadership team that we developed within FIRE that was comprised of individuals at all levels of the organization. We did have sworn and non-sworn. We had various ranks within the organization. We also had different divisions represented. And we came together as a team and worked through the standard of cover. We made modifications. This time when we went through it, it was a lot less time intensive than 2004. We also utilized a lot of information technology support in producing maps and running data analysis and queries. As I said before, this is the composition of the CFAI team. So we spent about 6 months reviewing this version and putting this together for you today. We did have review by labor and management in addition to the core leadership team. And the core leadership team is our management team for Portland Fire, all of our division heads, and our human resource coordinator. These are the elements of the Standard of Emergency Response Coverage document. We have an overview, which talks about the jurisdiction we serve. It gives kind of the basic information about, you know, demographics and population, assess values. We also have risk assessment and frequency of calls, just to give you an idea of what is included in our jurisdiction, what areas do we need to focus our efforts on, call volume, you know, magnitude of calls that we're experiencing, time and on-scene performance, distribution of resources. So this is how resources are spread throughout the city, where they're located, concentration of resources, how many units do we have at the various stations, and how are we addressing service needs in those different fire management areas. Response reliability. Response reliability shows us the capability of the first due unit or first due station, their ability to take their first due calls for service. So what happens if they're not able to take their first due call for service? A neighboring jurisdiction has to take their call, and that can impact response time. So response reliability is an important component of looking at service delivery. It shows you know, how busy we are and how call volume is impacting our service delivery. Performance is just raw performance data, response times, how we're meeting our response times or not meeting our response times in various response performance areas. So it could be hazmat, tech rescue, river rescue. It looks at performance in all of those areas. Future needs, we go through the department, we identify needs for improving infrastructure, information technology improvements, improvements to how we're delivering our services from the stations. It may identify some of our internal fire systems and how they need to be enhanced to better collect data. I know there's some information in there regarding risk assessment and collecting better risk assessment data in the field. And then we have service goals where we address our plans for response improvement over the next 1 to 3 years. And then we also have a large component at the end of maps, because maps are a great visual to show, you know, how we're delivering services, what hazards are out there. It actually has a great map in the back that shows response times by fire block, which is very informative. Significant outcomes, we realize we're at 7 minutes, 10 seconds, 90% of the time for response times, even though our goal is 520. So we know we're coming short on that. We have seen some improvements in that because we're wrapping up the general obligation bond and a lot of our stations are back in service and have been remodeled, and we don't have as much data that needs to be pulled out of the analysis because of station closures. So we're getting to a point where we're going to have more reliable data, data that won't have to be adjusted so much because of the geo bond projects. So, and we're anticipating to see that response time improve, but it won't improve significantly with the geo bond. You're going to see more improvements by actually adding units to the stations, because there's just so many calls for service that, you know, without adding resources, it's going to be challenging to get that number down. But we're doing our best to look for creative ways of doing that. We have identified response time goals for our full complement dispatching. So that's when we're sending multiple units to various calls like residential alarms or commercial alarms. We've identified a 15 to 18 minute response time goal for those call types. We have seen response reliability improve overall in the city since the last CERC document. I think that has a lot to do with the geo bond and the changes we've done with the stations. I think we're going to probably see additional improvements, especially in the areas where we've added rescues. So we already know that 11s has improved by 12% from this time last year just by adding that rescue. And that's a huge improvement.
And that's out in Lentz.
Pardon me?
That's out in Lentz.
Yes. Right. Yes. And as I already mentioned, geobond activities have impacted performance in various fire management areas. I will mention we're still not able to meet NFPA 1710. This is a national standard for fire service delivery. It's a very high bar to meet, and it'd be very challenging for us to meet that without literally doubling the units at all of our stations. So it's definitely a national standard, but it's challenging to meet. And we talked about this several years back with the mayor, and you know, how could we ever meet 1710? And the number was just so large, you know, that we just kind of have to take baby steps and try to find ways to, you know, improve where we can in the areas that are the most lacking in the city and try to focus our efforts. Okay. Additional outcomes from the CERC. We will be taking any of the goals and recommendations, service level objectives that come out of the CERC, and we will be folding those into our either our five-year strategic plan or our annual business plan. You may or may not know this, we do an annual business plan every year, and so whatever objectives council adopts through this CERC or any goals that you adopt through this CERC, we'll fold those into our annual business plan and make those a high priority. We have baseline unit and station level ratios for fatigue for the firefighters and the stations. We hope to improve that data and improve the information that we're getting out of the systems by making modifications to our information technology. Right now, we have a little bit of a problem with consistency in how data is being reported in order for us to really get a good gauge of firefighter productivity and fatigue. But that's something that we definitely want to focus on as call volume increases. We definitely have a better understanding of the risks within the community, but we still see that there's opportunities for improvement. I think we can get more information in the field, you know, through inspections and collecting more data about the buildings that are out there and what kind of hazards exist. So we're going to focus our efforts there as well. Benefits of developing a CERC. We have formally recognized our standards, goals, and performance. We're very clear about our service level objectives and what customers can expect us to deliver, which I think is very important to do. We have identified ways to incorporate any improvements into our long-range plans and our annual business plan. We have labor and management working cooperatively on creating a plan that provides effective service delivery of emergency operation services to the public. And we have a process in place for making sure that this doesn't just sit on the shelf, that it's put into place and that we adopt it on a regular schedule and that it's constantly modified and adapted to reflect the services that we're delivering. And we have a thorough understanding of our performance and how we can improve. So next steps. We are seeking, Mayor and Commissioner, we're seeking your adoption of the CERC by resolution. And once we have that adoption, we will be folding in our service goals and improvement plan to our annual business plan and five-year strategic plan. We will continue to modify and reassess the CERC biannually. So you will see us back here again in 2 years. And we will also be continuing to maintain our CFAI accreditation. We'll be fulfilling their requirements, which includes an annual compliance report, as well as undergoing a full external assessment again at the five-year mark, which will be in 2011. So you can be looking for that. And that's all we have. So if you have any questions, Mark and I are happy to answer those.
In terms of accreditation, mm-hmm. In 5 years, would you, you know, if it goes as planned, would you be then reviewed once more, but perhaps also accredited at that time? Or what's the steps in the actual receiving of the accreditation?
We would be, we would have another CERC document come before council in 2010, in addition to our five-year strategic plan that would go before council in 2010. And then in 2011, the external assessors would come to Portland and do a thorough review of our agency. We have to have those two documents approved and adopted prior to the external assessment, or they will defer us.
You have to have the resources at that time as well to fill the gaps to get down to the 5 minutes?
No, we don't. I think the goal of having a standard of cover, and I'll let Mark interject here, is that we have a plan in place for improvement. Whether or not it means you're going to get to that point in 5 years or 10 years, we just have to be able to show them that we are looking at it and we realize there's a gap and we're, you know, doing the best we can to identify the gap and do something about it.
The key here is to have a plan and to have it on the radar, and we certainly have that. And like I said, we've addressed some of it already through two of the rescues being added. We requested two more rescues, as you know, in this current budget, and that was based entirely on this document. So we're moving forward with the document. We always have it on our desk, and that's what we're using to justify.
So I'm sorry if I missed this, but is the Bureau currently accredited by CFAI?
Absolutely.
Okay, so
absolutely.
We're discussing doing the things to maintain the accreditation.
Maintaining. Okay. In 2011, we'll go through the formal process again.
Okay. Yeah, we got accredited in 2006.
In 2006. Yeah. I missed that.
That's okay. And we're doing an annual compliance report every year.
That's a big deal. Yeah,
it is.
It is a big deal.
It's a huge...
The process itself was assessors coming out for a week and living with us
here. I'm actually very familiar with the process. And So I was looking through here to find something that said you had been accredited. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge achievement for the Bureau to receive that accreditation.
Yes.
If we don't publicize it that much. We probably could more. Sure. We don't have the seal on our website, and we haven't put
Clackamas
the sticker
County
on the rigs. But
oh, you do have a sticker.
We don't have the stickers on the rigs. We could.
Clackamas County actually has on their rigs, I notice, their accreditation. So I think it's something to
be proud of.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I just want to comment that I'm pleased that with the additional rescue units, we've been able to enhance our response time to the good folks who live on Mount Scott.
They appreciate that.
So could you tell me just a little bit about who is the Committee on Fire Accreditation International? I thought you said most of the cities accredited are Canadian?
No, three of them are Canadian out of the 122. Oh, okay. The rest are national. Okay. The Commission on Fire Accreditation is actually a sub-unit of the Center for Public Safety Excellence. They've gone through a couple reorganizations, but most of the information you would find on CFAA you're going to find through the Center for Public Safety Excellence.
As I recall, they're city managers. They're not necessarily people just in the fire profession, although that includes that, but a wide array of folks that are responsible for delivering services. So it's a very objective and tough.
Yes, we had human resources folks come out, like you said, city manager.
Right.
So. Yeah, this is true. With CFAI in particular, there is a fairly strong fire presence, but it is a diverse background of assessors that come out and look at us. So they're hitting all angles of the organization. And when you do accreditation, you're not just focused on emergency response. You are looking at all aspects of the organization. Yeah.
So is the Center for Public Safety Excellence a nonprofit organization? Are they?
I'm pretty sure they are, yeah.
They don't do lobbying?
Not that I know of.
It is akin to the National League of Cities, if not a part of that organization. I don't recall exactly, but it is analogous to the National League of Cities.
I can certainly do some research and get back to you if you want to know. I can find out.
Well, yeah, just my curiosity. And then finally, I wanted to ask, is the so there's no connection to the Committee on Fire Accreditation and the NFPA. Well, I forgot what that stands for, National Fire.
1710, no, none at all.
No connection?
No connection.
It's a separate
at all.
Organization?
Totally separate organizations.
I'm sure they're aware of what each group is doing.
There are members that may belong to both organizations, but they.
And then, so, you know, what is, I see the value to the Bureau in having to do something like this every couple of years, I guess. Is there any value to the public? I mean, does this affect property insurance rates or anything like that, fire insurance rates, anything like that?
It's not going
to be accredited.
We're at the highest rating we can receive for the city of Portland, based on our geographic location and the river running through the center of town. So we're at the highest rating we can receive already.
What I found valuable about this organization when I started focusing on it a number of years ago was it kind of removed the politics out of staffing and how many firefighters you need and what are the appropriate response times. Back when I was advocating for some of those issues, it was really a matter of how politically connected you were, whether you could make the case or not. The benefit to the public of this is it's an objective, professional look at what your standards should be, and it removes the politics out of it. It's, if you meet these levels of services, you get a credit. If you don't meet them, you don't. So what that means for the public is you have good response times, you have staffing levels where they should be, you have water supplies in an adequate quantity, the rigs are maintained on a regular basis, so you know they're going to run efficiently. They administer the Bureau in an efficient manner. So what I found valuable about this, it was just an objective analysis of how a fire department should be run and remove the politics out of it.
Mm-hmm. And to take it one step farther, if you don't have those resources, if you don't have those means, it requires you to set the goals to try and achieve them over a long period of time.
And the bottom line is if you're trapped in a house and dial 911, you want somebody to answer the phone. You don't want to be placed on hold. And then you want somebody to get there as quickly as possible to get you out of the house. And you know, that's a very short synopsis of what this attempts to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So I'm very proud of your work. It's very good.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Mayor, I just would like to thank Chief Schmidt for pinch hitting today and compliment Ms. Brumfield for an excellent presentation and a lot of good hard work on this project.
I'd also like to thank a couple people on my staff, Mark Bunster and Carol Boucher, for their involvement with the standard of cover and making sure it got reviewed and updated in a timely fashion.
Thank you, folks. Excellent job. Do you have folks signed up to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
Is there anyone here in this room who wishes to testify to this specific issue? It's a resolution. Call the vote.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Well, this, as I said, this is something I focused on a number of years ago, this whole process, and was really excited when Chief Wilson undertook this initiative to get this accreditation, and somehow I missed that it actually happened, or I would have certainly said something at the time. So, to the extent that I have had any success in the management of the bureaus I'm assigned, I will give credit to my training in the Fire Bureau of allowing me to understand what it means to deliver good service. And it's something I learned in my first year being on the council. I had taken for granted until I was given assignments that, frankly, didn't live up to the standards I was used to in service delivery to the citizens. And so if anybody in my current assignments want to know what my expectations are or potentially any future assignments I may have, they may look at this report or talk to Chief Schmidt or Chief Klum to learn how the Fire Bureau delivers services, because I continue to be proud of the work you do, and I'm very pleased to support this excellent report. Aye.
Adams?
I had to step out, but I was watching on the monitor. Sounds like very challenging and very doable, and so I enthusiastically support it. Aye.
Saltzman?
Good work. Aye.
Potter?
I want to thank you folks and also the men and women of the Fire Bureau. I think you folks do a great job, and I think our community is very grateful for the work that you do to protect them. Aye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please read the 10 a.m. time certain.
Accept report to Council on Airport Futures Aviation Forecasting.
I'd like to invite Gil Kelly, Director of the Planning Bureau, Bill Wyatt, Director of the Port of Portland, Bill Blosser with the Advisory Group Chair. And we're going to also be having Catherine
Charlo,
Planning Commission, and Jay Signet, Bureau of Planning, and Chris Porridge from the Port of Portland speaking. You folks begin where you need to.
Okay. Good morning, Mayor and Council. Gil Kelly, Director of Planning with the City, and you've announced who's here at the table. I just had a few brief introductory comments, and then I want to turn it over to Bill Wyatt from the Port, the Executive Director at the Port of Portland. You remember that Bill and I were here just about a year ago, I think it was, last June, which was an event that was preceded by a couple years worth of negotiations with the Port of Portland and the City around how to kind of recast the long-range planning efforts for the airport in Portland. And at a juncture well before that, we had come to realize that the conditional use permit process really was not the way to master plan for a facility of this importance and this magnitude. And so we said we really need to set on a different course and got your permission to do that, that would meet both the Port's and community's desires for at once having more long-term certainty and also more flexibility over time than the conditional use permit process would allow. So you may recall we went ahead with certain amendments to the old master planning system to get some immediate improvements underway for the airport, and then launched this process for the longer range planning. And one of the advents in this was to marry up both the Port's internal master planning process and the city's land use planning processes. And a further conversation led to the notion of having that process be not only open to the public, but actively engage a bi-state constituency of citizens and other stakeholders in the formation of a project advisory group. And we were lucky enough to find Bill Blosser to head that up, and he's still with us doing that. We've had a great group So today we're really here just to give you a progress report on that long-range planning process. I have to say that I'm very, very happy about the way the partnership has worked and the way the community involvement has worked. We got off to a pretty, it was a robust discussion on the city's part to really come to a level of comfort around the setting of the table for this process, including the membership of that public advisory group. And I think we're both pretty happy with the way that it's worked out. So others will explain more in detail about that. The other thing I just wanted to let you know about from my point of view as both a planner and a public administrator is that I think the particular way in which that group has been involved in the process for modeling demand forecasts, which you'll hear about in a moment, which is really the foundation piece for doing any planning, has been remarkable in its openness and its dialogue and its inventiveness and creativity. And I think the technical aspects of that modeling are really something we should all be pretty proud of, because I think it really is breaking new ground. And I think maybe is in contrast to another little project just downstream you might hear about tomorrow in terms of how the demand forecasting there didn't take into account the same kind of externalities, if you will, as the way they're traditionally viewed, in deciding what future demand might be. In this case, it was very, very explicit about taking on rises in fuel costs, a whole series of factors. I think there were 25 variables looked at, everything from perceptions and threats of terrorism to rising fuel costs, to really settle in on what was a reasonable assumption around a range of potential future travel demands at the airport facility. So I think we really truly have a state-of-the-art process here that we're worked on, and I think everybody has embraced that. It's just a great foundation piece for doing the more difficult work now in planning exactly what should occur over the next 20 years or so at the airport. So with that, I just want to turn it over to Bill.
Great. Mayor Potter, members of the council, I'm Bill Wyatt, Executive Director of the Port of Portland, and I just I want to echo Gil's comments. I think from our perspective, this has really been a terrific undertaking. I don't know that any of us would have predicted at the beginning that we'd be sitting here a year hence saying that, but it really has been extraordinary. And it's if you sort of step back for a moment, what is, in my opinion, extraordinary about it is you have two different units of government, the city, which has a very broad and important jurisdiction, in this case for planning, and the port, which is the owner and operator of the only airport in our region that provides commercial air service and other air service facilities as well. With obviously an enormous impact in every sense of the word on the community. We have an obligation to do a long-range facilities plan. We do that periodically. Our partners in this, the FAA, are insistent appropriately that we're always evaluating and looking at infrastructure and being certain that we're able to meet the long-term needs of our community on the one hand, and we have managed to integrate that process with a more traditional land use process. And I think doing both of those at the same time is ideal and a lot easier said than done. So my hat's off to the members of the PAG, whose leaders you'll hear from in a moment here, who've really done an exceptional job of engaging people. It's a wide ranging committee of citizens and interested parties. I'm sure that not everything they do is scintillating or fascinating. There's just a lot of heavy lifting to be done. Some of it probably a little boring from time to time, but in the end, really an extraordinary process. I think the other thing I want to say, it's important to distinguish planning from facility development. At the airport, we develop facilities based upon demand, and part of this process is to try and understand as best we can what the demand will be. And if you can imagine where we were a year ago in terms of the air service industry and where we are today, I think you've gained some appreciation for why it's important not to try and read into the planning process a specific scheme for development, because times change. And I would be more than happy, if you want to get into this later, we've spent a great deal of time looking at not only the forecast, which the PAG has spent a great deal of time and energy on, too, but also talking specifically with carriers and with our own internal consultants, kind of looking at the future and trying to understand what's happening and what it means, because this is all very fast-breaking. And I think does have the potential for some impact, but some perspective might be useful. So I want to turn this over now to Bill Blosser, who I hope is still pleased that he agreed over a year ago to take on this charge, and who is remarkably well-suited to the role. And I think has just done a terrific job of helping us manage through not just a complicated process, but one that is from time to time very charged. And I think his stewardship is a large part of why things have gone so well.
William? Thank you, Bill. I remember sitting here a year ago and the agony that you and the Port Commission were going over the appointment of the members of this the PAG, and I want to tell you that it was worth the agony. It set a tone that's been very important for us, and that tone has been, we're inclusive, we want to hear all the issues, we want everybody to be at the table. And that tone has carried forward in the building of a working relationship among the 30 people in that group that is remarkable, given the wide diversity of interests that are involved there. And so I compliment you for hanging in there and for insisting that we add some members. It really has worked out very well. We adopted our vision and values for the group unanimously. And recently we adopted the forecast unanimously, something that I thought could never possibly happen. And that came from a lot of hard work by the members of the committee together with the consultants and the staff of the city and the port. And everybody came down to a conclusion that this is a fair forecast, particularly given all the uncertainties, and the staff will talk to you about that. So I'm very pleased with how it's been going, and I give a high degree of compliment to the staff of both the city and the port for it working so well. They have really been open to considering any issue, put it on the table, we'll talk about it, and that's really set, as I said, a very important tone. One of the other things that's important is that sustainability has become a very integral part of all the discussion, and that will carry through clear to the final plan, and I think you'll see some very nice results out of that, both on the port planning side as well as on the city land use plan side. So with that, I look forward to coming back and having the same tune to sing to you in another year or so, because I expect things will go nicely. And if they keep going so well, we may even finish a year or so early. But we'll see.
The Planning Commission has a particular role, as you know, in this process, in that they will be the ones making recommendations to you on the land use plan that comes forward as a part of this. And Catherine Charlo from the Planning Commission has been the Planning Commission representative to the PAG, and we wanted to allow her some time to give her perspective and thoughts today. Following the staff presentation, we'd also like to ask some of the PAG members who are here today to come up and give you their thoughts. Thanks.
I would like to just echo what Bill said.
State your name for the record.
Oh, please. Pardon me. I'm Catherine Ciarlo. I represent the Portland Planning Commission as a member of the PAG. And I'd like to echo what Bill said about including a number of members for the PAG that maybe hadn't been in the original PAG. We have a 30-person group, and as you might imagine, a 30-person group does not come to decisions easily. It's very slow. It can be very painful, and there's a wide diversity of opinions. But I think that the real strength of the decisions that we have made has come from that diversity. And so I commend council for staying firm on that. As you might imagine, the Planning Commission comes to this with a real interest in looking at, of course, what the the airport's interests are, but also what are the city's interests that might not be immediately evident. We have a tremendous interest in having a viable and vital airport, but we also have a number of environmental interests in the area. We have wildlife interests. We have a lot of neighborhoods that are strongly impacted by the airport, and the committee really has reflected a lot of those interests. And as we've made a few decisions, and Bill alluded to them, both some procedural decisions about how we tackle issues, but also the forecasting decision, I think what we've seen is a real willingness on the part of the committee leadership and staff to allow some of those neighborhood and environmental interests to really make their voices heard. And I think that as we move forward, that's going to be incredibly important. And then just a word about the forecasting. I think that process was very illustrative of the larger PAG in the sense that a subcommittee went into it. There were a lot of different opinions on how that outcome might look. The subcommittee came to a unanimous recommendation, brought it to the larger PAG, and that forecast really does reflect some of the variables that are out there today and that are going to be incredibly important as we make investment decisions for the future and for those investment decisions as they affect some of the city's interests out there. So thanks. And I guess when we had the presentation of the forecasting to the Planning Commission, Gil alluded to this, there was actually a hearing for a different project at that meeting, and a number of people who were testifying on the other project, which was the CRC, came up and in their testimony said, wow, that was a great forecasting and modeling process because it really did try to look at some of the variables that we're grappling with in the other project. So I think the role of that committee, the openness of the port to really have a process that considered some very tough variables, and then the city's peer reviewer played an incredibly important role in getting us to a decision that we all felt was going to be a good decision for moving forward. And, of course, we still have the decisions moving forward about the facilities that grow from that, but I'm optimistic that having had the experience of working through some of these initial tough decisions that the committee is going to be able to hold it together and come up with some good decisions for you, hopefully within 1 instead of 2 years. Thank you, Bill.
Questions?
Well, I think it's great to hear this process is working so well. I remember those discussions we had a year ago about the composition around the table. I don't know whether you were planning to leave this to others, but I think part of the news of this is the forecast as it relates to a third runway. Mm-hmm. Were you planning to talk about that?
We're actually, Chris, I think Korich from our staff is going to come up and talk about the forecast specifically.
Okay. Great.
Thank you.
I'll give you the punchline.
Yeah.
I was afraid the punchline might go not said, so I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. Sorry, Jay Sugnett with the Portland Planning Bureau. And it's great having Catherine and Bill here. Basically makes our job a lot easier. So this presentation will be fairly quick and painless. As they mentioned, integrated planning process, definitely. Planning for the future cargo and passenger needs of the region. So sustainability is definitely a big part of this. And how do we plan for those needs while making sure that we ensure that future generations aren't impacted in terms of livability? And we're also looking at how do we reinforce Portland's planning legacy and PDX, the reputation as a premier airport in the country. And as we mentioned, the planning advisory group is central to this larger public involvement process. The two products that will be coming back to council next year, hopefully, the end of next year, are the PDX master plan update and then the city land use plan. And it is a 3-year planning process. What Chris and I are going to do is talk about sort of where we are in the process review the forecast, the results, what are some of the next steps that are coming up, an update on the public involvement, and talk just briefly about the land use. So here's our schedule. As Bill mentioned, we're about a third of the way through. Back in the fall, we did our goal setting kickoff. We have completed the forecasting phase that Chris will talk about. We've started to look at what are the facility requirements based on those forecasts. And then once we know what the facility requirements are, we can start looking at, well, what are the alternative layouts for the airport? And then at the same time, we're going to be looking at what are the city land use plan and then come back for adoption in late 2009.
My name is Chris Korich. I'm the General Manager of Long Range Planning for the Port of Portland and the Project Manager for the Port. And I'll take over now and talk a little bit about the forecasts. And they're important to us because it helps us gauge what we need in the future. How big might the facility be if growth does occur? What kind of service levels do we want to have? What are the impacts and possibly what are the timings? But as Bill said, we don't build based on a forecast. We build based on actual growth. So in some ways, that is not super important. The forecasting, as everybody said, has been a super collaborative process. We've used the planning advisory group. We've developed a concept of subcommittees. Now, there are 30 people on the advisory group, but there are a lot more people with an interest. And the subcommittees are where we really throw the doors open and bring other people in. And that's been a real success for us. We've gotten very deep into the issues at the subcommittee level and let them really go down deep and wrestle and then bring it back to the full PAG. And as was stated, we had a unanimous approval on this, which was really not expected, and it was a real treat for us. Some of the key issues that were talked about in the forecasting process, clearly the aviation industry, you have to start there, and it's all about the cost. And clearly the fuel costs are hugely important to us. We're in an unprecedented level of cost there. The regional economic forecasts, we worked closely with Metro. Metro provided population and employment forecast. And if you take the number of people in the region times the kind of income that they have times the cost to travel, that's the basic formula that we used for forecasting travel demand. And we considered a number of other issues, but in the end, those were the three drivers. How many people, what kind of jobs and income do they have, and what does it cost to fly? And there were ranges of values for each of those variables. And then we did some sensitivity testing later. Clearly, aviation technology was an important discussion point and different things that could replace aviation. Global trends, whether it's economic or environmental, were all considered in the process, as well as unpredictable external events. If you were around in September of 2001, you know the kind of impact that that had on our travel. In the end, the graph that you see in front of you now is the passenger forecast, and there are three lines going off to the right of that. Now, we used a probabilistic forecast rather than a scenario-based. So those three variables that I had, population, again, from Metro, there was a high and a low. There was regional income, again, from Metro, high and low. And then travel costs, which included primarily the indicator there was cost of fuel, and that was the best surrogate we had. And so the formula was sampled at random 10,000 times. It's called a Monte Carlo approach, and that resulted in the probabilistic forecast you see on the screen there. Now, our planning level, the guide that we're going to use, is the blue line, which goes off to the right, and it says 13.4 million in 2035, and that's enplanements. That's how many people get on a plane, and most of the time, an equal number get off the plane. So right now, we're at 14 million total passengers, and that equates to about 26.8 million passengers in 2035. And we'll be using that as our planning guideline. But it's also important to note that there's a low line, a line on the bottom there, the red line. And if the population doesn't materialize, or the income, or fuel prices go dramatically higher, then there is a scenario which says we will not grow a lot in that intervening time frame. And so if the bottom line, which is the 10th percentile from a probability standpoint, is realized, then we'll be changing light bulbs and keeping things from leaking, but we won't be building a lot out there. And that would be a very, essentially a flat scenario. The scenario that results in about 13.4 million enplanements in the future is about a 2.3% growth rate. It's fairly modest. Again, it results in us just a little bit less than doubling. To give you an idea, Seattle Airport's about 31 million passengers, so we would be a little bit less than that level of activity in the future. In addition to the modeling factors that were actually in the model, we looked at